Welcome to Dark Materials. I'm Fear. Hi.
And I'm Rachel. Hello.
This is a podcast where we're reading through and discussing Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials novels, a chapter at a time, spoiler free.
In this episode, we are talking about chapter 33 of The Amber Spyglass, Marzipan. This is a very special episode. Mm-hmm. We have our first ever guest on a book chapter episode. Say hi, Jessie.
Hi, Jessie.
Hello. I feel very honored to not only be the first person on a book chapter, but for such a pivotal chapter in like the series and even in The Amber Spyglass in particular. It's just like, oh, thank you. What a
such
gift.
Such a chapter.
Yeah, when you sent through your list of chapters that you wanted to come on for us to pick one, we were like, I think it's got to be Marzipan. It's got to be that one. So we're very happy that you're here with us for this huge chapter.
Yeah, this is actually also kind of perfect timing because this week, later today, me and Lark are also recording an episode about a book that we're reading about terrible Christian fundamentalist church trying to stamp out queerness. And I'm just like, so my entire brain this week had just been like, wow, the many ways that like the Christian church is the worst and really just hates anyone having any kind of pleasure. And I'm like, oh my God.
So many ways.
So hopefully you won't lose too many listeners when I'm just like, the church.
Oh my God. Don't worry. That is our entire vibe for these books. So.
I mean, we literally just killed God like one chapter ago, two chapters ago. So like, don't you worry.
I know. Yeah.
So before we launch into it, I guess we need to ask you to do a little intro about yourself. Tell us about what you do for any of our listeners. We know quite a few of our listeners found us through your podcast, but if they haven't heard of your podcast, we'd love to hear a bit more about that. Just give us a little everything about Jessie.
All right. Yeah. My name is Jessie Blount. My pronouns are she, they, and I am one half of hashtag Ruthless. We formerly did a Harry Potter podcast, but now we do a podcast, The Gaily Planet. That's just whatever media we want to talk about. We have three other podcasts, one about the Simon Snow series, Escape from Reality, one about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, We Are the Gayers, and then an intermittent podcast, The Gay Pirate Podcast, about Our Flag Means Death, which is also going to be happening. We'll be recording early January 2024. So really the whole vibe of our podcast is just a ruthless queer feminist analysis of things that we do. And on The Gaily Planet, we actually are in the middle of his Dark Materials series. We're not doing it chapter by chapter because A, y'all are doing it chapter by chapter, and B, we just don't have the mental fortitude to do like a chapter by chapter book series that's not more than one, because we're already doing Simon Snow chapter by chapter, and we're like, this is fine. We'll just do an overall analysis.
Amazing. So we would love to know a little bit about your journey with His Dark Materials, like how you came to it, how it's impacted you. And then we'd love to know, because we're gonna go in a little bit, we're gonna go into what our demons are this week, but we'd love to know if you have a full-time demon and what that demon is.
Yeah. So I read the whole series when I was like 12 or 13. So like really like the prime age group to have read His Dark Materials and to be sort of like the series as a whole and like some of my like top five like favorite books ever written, you know. And I think part of it is that like as also like Harry Potter kid, I was like looking for something else that sort of like the same sort of like action adventure-y like fantasy, but His Dark Materials is a much like richer written text, and like Lyra's such a like evocative character, and the whole like concept of demons just like mind-blowing, especially to like young me, sort of like, oh, like this excellent sort of shorthand that's not culturally appropriate to try to be like, what sort of animal do you feel a, like, you know, soul level affinity to? So I love the series so much. I really want to get actually his Dark Materials tattoo. It hasn't happened yet.
But join the club. Yeah.
I know. I really want it because there's like a quote at the very last chapter, like the very last two sentences of this book, like never fails to like put a chill up my spine. And I'm like, what a excellent way to live your life. So I am deeply invested in this series in a way that is totally fine and healthy.
I mean, you're talking to
TV. Same. That's why we've got a podcast.
Exactly.
You know?
totally normal amount of interest.
Absolutely.
It's definitely not the kind of series, you know, that takes over your life for 4 years. Is it 4 years we've been doing this podcast
now?
Wild.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't watch other media and I'm like, oh, I wonder what their demons would be. I don't do that at all, ever. Yes. No.
Absolutely not.
Anyway. So having said all that, yes, I have thought a lot about what my all the time demon would be, and it is a fox. And I think a lot of people who know me would assume that it is a cat, because I'm obsessed with cats and I love cats. But I feel like, for sort of like my own personal journey, like when I was like a young person, like adolescence, in high school, I had like a lot of just like really intense life stuff happening. And so I really kind of imagined like a bit more of a like, wild survivor kind of animal. And like foxes are just like known for being like, they're hard to hunt. They like, I know that y'all in the UK, like London foxes are like a meme almost. They're just like, they're everywhere. And they're just like,
London foxes are like New York rats. They're their own like,
yeah,
subculture of like foxes.
Right. Or like Toronto raccoons. We're just like, there's just so many of them. We can't easily get rid of them. So here you go. And you know, and there's just, and I think for me also, because a lot of the demons in this series, it's obvious that like Phil Pullman likes to go for like not only what fits the character, but sort of a like wider symbolism and mythology of like literature and art, like kind of really influences how, what people have, what demons. And so it's kind of like, it's like, foxes, like, are they tricksters? Are they going to be nice? Is it like, there's sort of like so many like mythologies about what foxes mean that you're like not really sure what you're going to get. And I've always really appreciated that as someone who just has a like, I don't want to say a lot of confusing intersectioning identities, but it's like I'm bisexual, like I'm queer, like I'm trans mask. And a lot of it's just like, I don't understand how you can be in the gray area between the two binaries. It's like, you can just do that. So, and I'm like, I don't know. Foxes feel very queer in a way that I can't articulate, but I'm like, great. Yes.
Yes. That is great. That's great. I love foxes. I love, me and Rich were both in, well, not anymore, but we lived in London for like 10 years. So we've both had so many like, interesting interactions with foxes. I remember on like more than one occasion, one being sat outside the like door to my apartment building and me just being like, I just can't get in. just like having like a stare off with this fox. Like, I don't want to go too close because I don't want to scare it. And also I don't want it to attack me. So I'm just like, I guess I'm not going home.
Like, for me, it was when we lived in the flat in the summer and having the windows open being like, is somebody being murdered outside? Oh no, it's just a fox screaming into the night, just screaming away. And you'd be like, I feel you, friend. I feel you.
Sometimes you're just like, yes, I too just want to scream into the night. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad someone is.
Right. Every time it like woke me up, I'd be like, it's a bit annoying, but also respect it.
Can I join in?
I too will just stand in the alley and scream for a while.
So, shall we move on to what our demons would have been this week?
Yeah, no, let's dive into it. And I guess it's usually my cue. I get to go, hey, Faye. But this time I'll go, hey, Faye and Jessie. What would your demons have been this week?
Okay. Jesse, I know you just told us about your full-time demon, but you are the guest, so you should definitely go first and tell us what your demon would be this week, and if it would be different to your full-time demon.
You know, I'm going to, you know, really embrace the spirit of, you know, chapter episodes, and I do actually have a demon of the week, which is a xolo, or a Mexican hairless dog, because I was feeling very sick earlier this week for what is, fingers crossed, not COVID. And Mexican hairless, because they're like hairless, they're apparently really, really warm, Mexican hairless dogs. And I'm like, that sounds like the perfect thing to just cuddle with in my sickness. Yeah, they're also one of the oldest recognizable dog breeds in the world, and like have a lot of cultural significance in like Mexico and Central America. And if anyone's seen the movie Coco, the main character's animal companion Dante is also a xolo.
Yeah, nice.
I love that film so much. We always laugh about it because I can't even see the thumbnail on Disney Plus of Coco without crying. Like, I honestly, it's just my niece made me watch it the other week, Rich. I forgot to tell you. And she was like, are you going to cry yet? Are you going to cry? I'm like, stop it. I'm already crying. How dare you?
You suggested it.
Me and Lark have been talking about doing an episode about Coco because the movie is so good, but I think it makes us cry so much. We're like, we're not ready to do that yet.
That's fair. I don't think I could get through a podcast episode talking about Coco. I can barely get through a conversation talking about Coco. So, oof. Oh, wow. Wow, wow, wow. That's a great demon, though. Mm-hmm. Really good demon. Interesting that they're really warm without fur.
Yeah.
Just living their best lives, being toasty.
Truly.
So, Jesse, you might not know this, but the last couple of, I'd say like the week or so before last in the UK was ridiculously hot for September. It was so hot, and we don't have like systems built to have air conditioning in like our houses or anything like that.
Because it didn't really get hot there.
Except for randomly for an entire week in September.
Yeah, it was like, I guess, what did we get up to? It wasn't as bad this year as it was last year. This year we got up to 30 degrees centigrade. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. And then the year before we got to like 40, and I think that's near like 100.
Yeah, that's really hot. I'm sorry. That sounds so miserable.
Oh, God, it really is. But this week, it's starting to get a little bit cooler, get a little bit... I mean, the weather is rubbish. It's raining.
We've had some really cool thunderstorms though, right? Did you see the like crazy lightning?
Yes,
we had like
Stranger Things.
Like red lightning at one point in like parts of the country. It was very cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was cool. So my favorite season is autumn, like spooky season. And I feel like we're finally approaching it. So I've gone simple. It just came to me, and I've not even like selected a certain species, but I'm just going to go with a bat because I love bats so much. I did recently buy some like bat themed like bedding as well, and a bat themed blanket. So I'm like, I'm just going to embrace and just say bat.
it's still bat weather as well, because the heat and the humidity has brought out more bugs. And so the bats are like getting in their like last of the summer, like all the snacking done. So you're probably more likely to see a bat while it's warm as well, just before autumn, because they're like, eat everything.
Bat buffet, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. I'm going to keep my eye out now to see if I can see any on a night. What about you, Rich? What would your demon have been this week?
So I, like you, I'm very excited for spooky season. I was Googling around, like, I don't know what I'm feeling this week. And I was like, spookiest animals. And I came across the ghost bird, or the patoo, P-O-T-O-O. And it is, where are they based? This is, Central and South America, excluding Chile, is where they're based. But they are like, they look kind of owlish, which is very nice, very cool and spooky. But they have these like giant but very shallow mouths and the giant yellow eyes. And I want to send you a picture of one that's like the first one that came up that made me go, okay, well, it has to be this guy.
I just Googled it.
I also just Googled it because I've never heard of this bird. What a weird looking bird.
He's such a weird little guy. And so what I love about them is they're called ghost birds because they're so funky looking. There's quite a lot of like local myths and legends that are kind of like stem from the like people seeing this bird and being like, the fuck is going on there? But then also a really lovely part of them is they have these really dappled feathers, and they can like almost perfectly blend into tree branches for when they wish to just not be perceived. And I've been feeling very don't perceive me recently, which is so I appreciate that from them. So it's like they can either be spooky as heck and get like legends written about them and like start some like urban legends and like myths and lore, or they can just be just unperceived and just be tree, and like that's great. I would like those two options to be my
perfect
options.
Yes, love those two ends of the spectrum. Yeah,
and they're just so funky looking. I love it.
Yeah, they're so funny. What a good start to spooky season.
Yes. Okay, well, shall we delve into this chapter? I'm very excited.
Let's do it.
Last chapter, Lyra and Will found themselves in the Malefa world with Mary, where they had some food and a well-needed rest.
Mary travelled with the Malefa to discover the window where the stream of ghosts are escaping the land of the dead.
In this chapter, Lyra and Will get more comfortable in the Malefa world, spending a day eating and working alongside them and Mary.
Will and Lyra tell Mary their stories, and Mary tells them hers, which awakens something within Lyra. Let's launch into it.
So, Jessie, one question I had for you is, does your copy of the... I don't know if you have a physical copy of the books or you read them on, like, an e-reader, but do they have the little image that Phil drew in the quote at the top?
It does, actually.
It does. Okay. So, in Rachel's copy, she has the quote, but she doesn't have the picture.
What?
Yeah, the quote, but the quote's written into a box, so I don't have the pictures.
Weird.
She's so sad. She's a very old copy. It's getting real scrappy in here.
So, Rach usually tells us about the quote, and I get her to guess what the image is. And obviously, Jessie, if your book has the image already, you cannot participate, I'm afraid.
That's all right.
Okay, Rach, can you guess what this image might be?
It's a little piece of marzipan.
Oh no, it isn't.
Oh, it isn't. That was it. That was my guess. It's a piece of marzipan. What else happens this chapter? I mean, they tie up some nets, but we've already had them tying ropes. Is it them tying nets?
Yeah.
Is it just a net?
Oh, you got it.
That's got so little to do with the important part of the chapter. Yeah. Why have you drawn
that? I don't
even
see that.
Yeah.
It's just some hands tying a net together. You got it. You smashed it. I think that might be the first one you've got in ages.
Oh, thanks.
Very happy
for
you.
Yeah. I feel like he really like buries the lead on the drawing sometimes.
I think because as the chapters get more complicated, it must become, as you know, Rach, because you do with your drawings, it just gets more. The concepts get bigger and the ideas for illustrations also get bigger. But then you're like, well, actually, how can I put that onto something that makes any sense whatsoever? So I guess he's having the
same
issue.
I give up. I'll just draw a rope.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like if it's not that or a like piece of marzipan, then you're kind of just like, all right, what other object are you going to do? Okay.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the quote for this chapter is, "Sweet spring full of sweet days and roses, a box where sweets compacted lie," which is very nice.
Very sweet, have
very sweet. It seems to be nice and clear kind of why this quote is here. I always do a little bit of research on this and enjoy because I am a bit scatterbrained today, and part of this research made me laugh a bit too hard. So this is a poem from a guy called George Herbert. He's a contemporary of Shakespeare and Milton. So he's kind of born around the 1593 marker, late 15, early 1600s is his time. Born wealthy, educated at Cambridge, became a public speaker / preacher. Phil loves to pick somebody that has like a religious background. Maybe that's just because everybody did in those days. And then very much choosing some of this content to flip it on its head. So it's another vibe of that. He was training to be like a politician and do all sorts of stuff, but then he was like, "Nah, I'm gonna be a preacher, and I'm gonna write poetry for fun." And so it was it was shortly before his death that he sent a literary manuscript to his friend Nicholas Farrar, reportedly telling him to publish the poems if he thought they might turn to the advantage of any dejected poor soul, and otherwise to burn them. So like, I'm just gonna send if you think it's good. Just you can publish it. If just burn it. Just throw it away. Just burn it. It's trash. It's trash. And obviously, his friend Nicholas Farrar thought they were good and published them in a book. So all of his poems are collected together in a book called The Temple, Sacred Poems and Private Ejaculations.
Oh, wow. Okay.
What a choice book name. And I would love to know if that was a post-mortem prank from him on everybody else or by his friend on him. Or if it just meant something very different in those days. It's a choice book name. But a fun part of his book and his poems is that he tended to like write things in a way that was very... he tended to have fun with layouts, basically. So like he had a series of poems that were called... there's one poem called The Church Porch, and it's followed by The Altar, and that's followed by The Sacrifice, like in the way that they're listed in the book. And then he's got a poem called Easter Wings, and it's... across two pages, and if you like open the book, it like the what's the word for when poems make a picture? Basically, it looks like wings because of the way that he's written it, and it's like, oh, cute, you're having like you're having fun with poetry. This is nice. Yeah. So the vibe of this poem that this is pulled from, it's only a little short four stanza thing. So I could, do we want to hear it? It's a little bit Shakespearean-y in the language, but it's not too bad.
I mean, yeah. I would love to hear it.
Yeah.
Cool. So the poem is called Virtue. So, sweet day, so cool, so calm, so bright, the bridal of earth and sky, the dew shall weep thy fall tonight, for thou must die. Sweet rose, whose hue, angry and brave, bids the rash gazer wipe his eye, thy root is ever in its grave, and thou must die. Sweet spring, full of sweet days and roses, a box where sweets compacted lie, my music shows ye have your closes, and all must die. Only a sweet and virtuous soul, like seasoned timber, never gives, but through the whole world turned to coal, then chiefly lives. So basically, the vibe of the poem is everything is fleeting, you're all gonna, everything dies, except for the virtuous soul.
Yeah. I feel like Phil likes to do that, likes to remind us of death at every turn. And also just the amount of times that poem says die.
You're all gonna
die. The guy really wanted to put his point across, didn't he?
But also for that, the message of that poem being everything is fleeting except for your virtuous immortal soul. And the message that Mary gives us in this chapter is kind of fuck that, live in the moment. Everything is fleeting, so relish what you have. And so it's kind of interesting that the poem he's picked kind of gives the opposite message to the chapter that we're about to read.
Yeah, it actually kind of reminded me of, I don't know why, but I feel like I often see on like Instagram someone quoting a like Mary Oliver poem that's like, tell me what it is you plan to do with your one wild and precious life. And I feel like this is sort of the vibe of like Mary's story, which is just like, does it matter to God? Eh, it matters to you though. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. All right. Should we get into this chapter? I'm ready.
Yes,
ready
yes.
to talk about it. Okay. So we start. Lyra is dreaming about Pan, and he appears to her in his final form, but she can't remember what it is.
Aww.
And that kind of like harks back to, I can't remember if it's the last chapter or the chapter before, where we were talking about, there was a quote, Jesse, about, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was about like dreams, like being really fleeting. And like you try, I think Phil used a metaphor of like trying to hold them in your hands, like water, and they like trickle away. And it's kind of given me that vibe again. And also what a tease as well for Phil to just be like, oh yeah, he did have a final form, but I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Don't get to know yet.
This whole chapter is a literal tease. It's just like, oh, hey, you're so close to the thing that you want. But you're just like right on the cusp of like knowing what it is. And I'm just like,
Yeah, 100%. So she's asleep in Mary's house and she wakes up naked. And I'm a little bit like, okay, who took off her clothes? Because that was quite the invasion of privacy there. I think I would be a little bit pissed off that somebody had just like stripped me naked in my sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not, there's a reason they did not do any of that in the TV series because it's weird, very weird. I, like Lyra, would be like, what the hell? And it's the fact that she then feels like, okay. She's like, oh, I can't believe that they took my clothes off. I'm so annoyed. And then instead of being still annoyed, she's like, oh, it's fine. They've given me some others. They're not expecting me to just walk around. It's like, no, Lyra, that's not the logic there. It's not that they were expecting you to walk around unclothed. It's that you Anyway, she will be fine because she's found her clothes and she's found Mary's clothes, which is she's got a lovely big Mary shirt on and a big strip of fabric to turn into a skirt so she can go out and have a potter around. And she can feel that Pan is somewhere nearby, but she can't quite put her finger on where. The way that she's thinking about Pan in these moments when she's on her own and she's just like wondering where he is, if he's close by, it harks back to the first book and all of the descriptions we've had of her like relationship with him and their closeness and their bond and her thinking about how they're going to get back to that and that like perfect relationship that they had. It's kind of like heartbreaking how she can like, again, with the hide and seek reference that we had last chapter about how she could like feel where he was when they were younger and she would know exactly, he could never play hide and seek with her. And now he's like a mystery and we don't know where he is. It's just a little bit heartbreaking.
I will say though, it is kind of nice to know that they're like still connected though. Like she can even sense him being nearby. Cause like, if you're reading this for the first time, you're like, you have no idea what this like traumatic separation is going to do to them, considering the only other kind that we get is like intercision, where you're just like, that whatever connects you and your demon is gone, you know? And this isn't like it's gone, it's just like it's been readjusted, like it's been stretched, but like it's not completely gone.
Yeah, 100%, because they mentioned, don't they, in this chapter that they're still connected. I think that for me, it took me this time reading it, because I'd only read the series once before we did the podcast. So I think it took me reading it in this format, in the kind of like, you know, analytic sense, to be like, oh yeah, I think that when Lyra and Pan got separated, I just assumed that they were fully separated. And it's nice to then learn that, well, yeah, they've got some, when they hopefully eventually meet again, they've got some rebuilding of their relationship to do, but they still are connected, which is nice to know, definitely.
I will say this is one of a few little reads that we get of a relationship with Lyra and Will here. She is thinking, she's looking around, she's figuring out what to do, and she notices that Will is asleep under the tree. And the quote is, "Will was still asleep under the tree, the lazy thing." Why is she reading him? But she has a few little moments like this, I think, where she's kind of reached a, oh, we're taking the piss out of each other a little bit in that relationship. There's like a humour to the way that she's thinking about him that hasn't been there before, because everything's been so serious. And I kind of love that she's like, heh, lazy guy.
I love the also like kind of righteousness of being the person that wakes up first and then be like, you're lazy because I woke up first.
Yes.
Yeah, I just love the casual like affection of it. It's just like, oh, you always asleep. And it's like, well, he's asleep for like another week, considering what y'all have been through.
Oh, gotcha.
You both should be so much. I mean, Lyra slept a lot during the first part of this book, but I'm like, Will needs another like 14 hours of sleep, probably. Poor kid.
100%. Oh my God. So we get Lyra talking about swimming on her own, like naked in the river. She used to do it in Oxford. And again, like, I think what you were saying, Jessie, about this entire chapter being a tease is that we get so much of like these little inklings of like Lyra and Will like noticing different things about each other, because it says, but it would be quite different with Will. And she blushed even to think about it, even to think about the fact that she would be swimming naked near Will is too, almost too much for her to think about, which is very sweet. And we definitely do get a lot of that this chapter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've had like a lot of reminders over the last few chapters of like how much they've been through and how much they've been like aged basically by the massive traumas that they've experienced through this last like couple of books. And this is like, we're coming back to the like softer reminders that they're growing up, and the softer reminders of it, like their awarenesses of their body and of like being in the last chapter. We had Will very definitely not looking in Lyra's direction when she was having a wash, in the same way that like the monkey and Pan were made to turn away when Coulter was bathing her. And I feel like this is that same energy, that like sudden awareness of your body as like a slightly gangly teenager.
Yeah, and I felt that scene in the Northern Lights where like Pan and the golden monkey had to turn around and Lyra's like, what? Why? What are you doing? And now I feel like she would be like, no, you were still wrong, Miss Coulter, but I kind of get it now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like, I want my privacy for my own reasons, not because you're telling me that I should have it, kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Not that I'm ashamed of my growing body.
Also, not from my own demon. Like, from somebody else with their own demon. Sure, like, give me my privacy, but from my own demon? What? That was what was so weird about it, for sure.
That's because it's shameful to be... I don't know. Whatever crap the Magisterium is like. I'm sure there's a lot of just like a extra thick layer of religious shame just up in there somewhere.
Oh yeah. Always. I am jealous of this swim that Lyra has. Like, it just seems so refreshing. Although I'm definitely not jealous of her being like really cold on the shore afterwards. But it also is very cute that Pan used to help dry her. Oh. It makes me miss Pan because we've just not seen him for so long.
Yeah. We're getting a lot of Pan chat in this chapter in a way that we kind of haven't in some while they've been separated, and it's a real reminder. What I am thinking about logistically is, how is Pan helping to dry her off? Does he turn into a really big dog and then they have to smell like wet dog for a while? Like, what is the situation? How is he help? Because it reads like it should make sense, but then logistically you're like, and then you have like wet fur all over you.
Oh yeah.
What is the most towel-like animal he could have turned it? Like a sheep? I don't know.
Oh my god, yeah, maybe.
Roll around on a sheep.
I was thinking like something big. Like, I'm thinking like a bear or something like that. Again, that wouldn't get rid of the having fur all over you kind of thing. But I feel like a bear could give you a big like hug and you could like kind of get dry that way. But then you would probably have to go and bathe again to get all the hair off you. So I don't know.
It is sweet that Lyra is still thinking of Pan. There is a kind of an edge to it in a little way, because she's thinking about him helping to dry her, but also she's thinking like, is he a fish right now laughing at her from under the water, or a beetle creeping into her clothes to tickle her, or was he a bird like somewhere nearby, or was he somewhere else entirely and just not even thinking about Lyra? And she's got that like that mystery there of like, is he staying away from me to punish me? Is he not even thinking about me? Is there's like an edge to it that is like, there's a fear there that we've not had from a lot from Lyra of like, but what if he's around but he's making fun of me and he doesn't want to see me? And like that vibe of like uncertainty between her and her demon is a thing we've not had exist before they got separated on that shore. She's not had that like fear around him. She's always been very certain of who Pan is.
For sure. It's also really interesting that we haven't had, because in this book, we are mostly from Lyra's perspective, but we have had chapters where we're from other people's perspective. We've done a fair few Mrs. Coulter chapters in here. Interesting that we have just not seen anything from Pan's side of things. We've only seen Lyra getting increasingly more upset about them being separated and trying to find him. The only time we saw him was when Lyra found him again, and then they obviously were separated again really quickly. So we just haven't had anything from Pan's side at all, which definitely adds to the uncertainness of what is happening between them.
I also think about that, like, we've also had chapters from the perspective of the witches, who we know can be be separated from their demons in a way that doesn't destroy either of them. But it's like, I feel like in those perspectives, except for like maybe the part where there's that one chapter in The Subtle Knife where what's her face gets eaten by a specter, it's sort of like they are operating as two separate entities, where it's like, you know, Serafina Pekla's doing one thing, Kazar's doing another thing, and it's like, she's not necessarily, like, Serafina Pekla isn't thinking about what her demon is doing in the way that, like, Lyra is, you know? So this is sort of the first time we're getting what that would look like.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. She goes to wash her clothes. They find that they've already been washed. Will's have already been washed as well. And then she goes to wake up Will. And the way that Will wakes up, with his like hand on the knife and he's like immediately alert to like danger, it just makes me so sad. The trauma that they've both been through, the fact that he's a literal child and that is how he's waking up, and she has to like reassure him that it's fine, we're safe, and I'm just like, oh, it just breaks my heart for them.
And it's so nice that they're safe now, though. The fact that she can just be like, no, it's fine, we're here. And also Mary's washed our clothes. How nice, yeah, for us. And like, you should go and have a bath. And he's like, oh my God, I can have a bath. Oh, good. Finally.
Okay. Actually, I have a question for both of you, because this literally hadn't occurred to me until right now. But is Will also naked? Because, like, Lyra wakes up, she's not wearing clothing.
Ooh. Interesting. Because his clothes have been washed. I assume he's under blankets because she gives him the clothes. So, yeah, surely under blankets.
I guess that makes sense.
But, like, if not, he's just fully laid under a tree naked.
Lyra would have noticed.
Yeah.
He would have been told. Lyra would have noticed. Yeah. No, I feel like, yeah, surely he has to be. It's fine. We're not thinking about it. Again, though, so they've already had a bit of a wash last chapter before they got to the Malefa village. So it's nice now that they get to have like a proper reset. And that Lyra gets to go and have a little wander around the village. I love some of the descriptions of the village that we get here. Especially there's like this little bit where Phil compares the way that the Malefa have like built their structures and like the layers of like meaning within the structures that they've built have matched the alethiometer. I thought I might read it out. The more she looked, the more she saw all kinds of order and carefulness in the village, like the layers of meaning in the alethiometer. Part of her mind was eager to puzzle it all out, to step lightly from similarity to similarity, from one meaning to the other, as she did with the instrument. But another part was wondering how long they'd be able to stay here before they had to move on. And it's like, it's so cool that there's so much stuff. There's things like, there's nothing crude about the shapes there. Each door and window frame and lintel was covered in subtle patterns, but patterns that weren't carved in the wood. It was as if they'd persuaded the wood to grow in the shape naturally. And Phil is very obsessed with how the Malefa are so symbiotic with their environment. And the fact that Lyra is noticing that and seeing it as like layers of meaning and like depth to the way that they work is beautiful. But also sad times for Lyra that she's like, I don't want to leave here. Like, when are we going to have to move again? I'm so on the go all the time.
Yeah. Just give me a minute. Just let me chill.
I mean, this place does seem pretty cool, so.
Yes. Everyone's awake now. They have some breakfast. Lyra plays with the baby Malefa, which is very cute. And she makes them jump because they're all staring at her. So she's like, I'm going to use this to my advantage. I'm going to make them jump, which is really cute. And Mary is taking what she learned last chapter very, very seriously in terms of telling stories. She's like, look, you know, today we can do all this stuff, but we're going to tell each other everything that we've found out and everything that we've learned along the way so far. And so it's really obvious that at the end of last chapter, when Mary learned about this, she has taken it extremely seriously and she knows that it's really, really important, which I really, really like.
Mm-hmm. Last chapter, she was all about giving them space to process and like not asking questions. In this chapter, she's like, right, folks, it's time to dish. I do love that. I love the little reference that we get just before we come back here. Is that they go and they get set up. They start to work on the nets and like tying them together. And the last little paragraph here is, so they sat working in the sun by the placid river and Lyra told her story from the moment so long ago when she and Pan had decided to look in the retiring room at Jordan College. And it's a classic, oh, look, we're coming to the end of the book. Let's remind you how much we've all grown. And do you remember chapter one? Do you remember chapter one? And you're like, I do remember chapter one. We were all so young and naive.
It's also like kind of wild that, what are we, like 5 chapters from the end of this book and Mary is just now hearing what is like the backstory of what is going on. And I'm like, oh, wow. You did all of this on like one conversation with Lyra and you're like changing the whole trajectory of my life on it.
I feel like Lyra just rocks up consistently and blows Mary's mind. Like that's what happened in the second book. And she got like a little bit of backstory of like, I'm running away from my evil mother and here is this and this and this. And oh, demons are a thing. You should make your machine talk to dust. And like,
and then pieces out again,
blowing her mind. And then now it's like, oh, and here's my entire life story. But also like, I can just imagine Mary's eyes growing like wider and wider and her trying not to look like horrified as she learns about like basically all of the trauma that these children have experienced. Like,
yeah,
it is so much for, as we learned, Lyra is about 12 and a half, 13, right? Mm-hmm. She's such a baby.
Yeah.
She's such a baby. And yeah, it's interesting. I kind of love it that Mary, I'd not really thought about it before, Jessie, until you brought it up, but like Mary was like, met Lyra once, and then got told by Dust to do something and she was like, yeah, hell yeah, I'll do it. Like, I don't really have much backstory or know really why I'm doing it, but sure, why not?
Yeah, it's just, it's funny because it really stood out to me. It's like, and especially because I've been like reading the book and listening to the audiobook and I'm like, I know how long this story takes.
Yeah, right. No wonder they don't get to finish before Mary gets to tell her story. They're like, let's leave it there. We're not going to get to the land of the dead. That's for another time.
Mm-hmm. We'll carry on this saga tomorrow. It's worth noting that through the whole of this chapter, there is this undertone of Mary's been warned that the two Alapi, the horrible, big, horrible bastard birds that we hate, are gathering en masse on the sea. The Malefa have observed it. There's like more two Alapi than usual, and like villages along the stretch of villages that Mary is living in are being attacked by two Alapi, and that's like an ever-present threat. So while she's having this like chill everybody tell our stories moments with the kids, Mary is constantly scanning the horizon and checking the sea to see if the birds are there, and it's kind of like an ever-present mild threat throughout the chapter that doesn't come to anything, but it feels like Phil's just like, just you wait.
You thought the danger was over. It's like, oh.
Here's some more shit to deal with. Yay.
Enjoy your break. Enjoy your stories. Who knows what's happening next? And you're like, I know what's happening next, Phil. You've hinted at it 12 times.
Yeah. Lyra tells a story. They are making the nets. And then when they're done finishing making the nets, they go out towards the sea in the late afternoon, which is really nice. Mary's like, okay, we're good, because those stupid bastard birds can only come in when the tide is high, so we're fine. Willie's like very interested in how the Malefa like came to be and how their world is, you know, different from his world and our world. It's kind of what you were saying, Rich, about the like symbiosis between the Malefa and their land, and it's just so beautiful because Will's like, did they make the roads? And Mary's just like, no, everything that they have was already there and has been kind of like molded in like a really lovely way to help everything around it thrive and grow. And the other thing, and in this particular section, is snakes are important here. The people look after them and try not to hurt them, which is a really like nice little nod to Mary playing the serpent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
snakes are important here, just like me. That everybody here is kind of a weird diamond framed invertebrate situation, so they really do love a vertebrate and snakes. Hello, I'm a vertebrate serpent type character. Yes, yeah. I love it.
I feel like in my notes I just had, we get it, Phil Pullman. Yeah, serpents are cool. The whole playing the serpent is a good thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks for letting us know that once again.
Yes.
That we're inverting all this stuff in the Bible. We're with you, Phil. We're on it.
I love the way that Mary passes the mic. So we get, and the way that their conversation flows is lovely. Like Lyra tells her most of her story and Mary goes, that's okay. We've had enough Lyra time now. And then let's have a little Q&A about the Malefa. Ask me your questions. And then Mary does a really good job of like passing the mic to Will and like, hey, Will, tell us like everything that's happened to you. And they get to have this like interesting little back and forth conversation when they reach the point where he's talking about meeting his dad on the mountaintop and him being killed by the witch. He'd never really understood that. He explained what she told him before she killed herself. She had loved John Parry and he had scorned her. And Lyra says, witches are fierce though. And he says, but if she loved him. And Mary says, well, love is ferocious too. And then Will gets to say, but he loved my mother and I can tell her that he was never unfaithful. And that's so sweet. And then Lyra is looking at Will and she thinks, Lyra, looking at Will, thought that if he ever fell in love, he would be like that. And it's like, oh, Lyra, cutie.
But also it's so true. I feel like it feels very true to Will to be like, okay, and thanks, witch. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think absolutely 100%. It is very true to Will. I also love the kind of like childlike naivety of it to be like, I know for a fact that Will would never be like that. And I agree with you, Jesse, that I don't think he would be, but that just childlike wonder and certainty of, I know they've been through so much, but Lyra doesn't know like the intricacies of relationships and things like that, and you know, things happen, and she's naive to that, and I do really like that. I love the like purity of their like love and feelings for each other is really nice because they've just never experienced it before.
It also just feels like a tiny mini version of the entire conversation of the chapter, because it's like the kids going story, but what about love? And then like Mary being the person that answers the question, the like grown up question of like what love is, what love does, like interjecting with like grown-up wisdom on kids being like, but what's going on with that? Relationships be crazy, right? And Mary's like, but here's some wisdom about love. And you're like, oh, just like a tiny mini version of what she's about to like lay down for them. It's lovely.
I mean, I still think that Witch was out of pocket about her feelings about John Perry, but that's just...
Oh, for sure.
Honestly, I... When we went to, when we got to that chapter, I was just a bit like, okay, get it, Witch. Like, bye, high and bye, basically. Like, cool.
She's one of the most, like, tiny little characters that pops through just purely just to be there. She's, what's the word? That she's, like... the Chekhov's gun of the of that book. Like, she's Chekhov's witch. She's laid out in the first chapter to like then show up and literally shoot someone in the last chapter. It's like, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. It just, it's the first time we see a witch do something that feels very immature human than like witch-like, which seems to be a like, I live for 1,000 years and people live for like 50 or 60. So the comparison of what it is to love and lose is much different for a witch than a human. But then she's just like, nope, I gotta kill him and myself because he scorned me. And I'm like, no, what? so many dudes in the world. Like, what?
Is there a comment made? I feel like there's a comment made between Ruta and Serafina about how she's a younger witch and she doesn't understand and she needs to be like taken under the wing of another witch. I'm sure there's like a tiny little snippet of conversation like that where they're like, we need to keep an eye on her. She's probably like 150 years old where everyone else is like 200 years old or something.
Right. And this is like her first time like being into a dude and he's like, not really. And that's like, is it a crush or is it you just like really, you know, because sometimes when you're like your first crush or someone you're like obsessed with, you're like, it doesn't turn out and you're like, no, what happened? And then you look back and you're like, I made that whole scenario in my brain that we were going to have a relationship, but it was really just a crush. Chill out.
Yeah. We get like a lovely description of, there's a lot of nice like nature descriptions again in this chapter. We get a lovely one about the tide and about like the million different creatures that live in the sand when the tide's going out. Mary's still scanning for those white sails. They gather mollusks that the Malefa love to eat, which I think is really sweet. But they've got like 3 pairs of hands to do it because the Malefa can't walk on the sand without sinking.
Yeah, or just like it's just a bit ungainly, I imagine, because you can't like wheel along wet sand easily.
True. So, and then they head back as the tide is turning. This is interesting because they pause their story. This is when we were talking about earlier, when Lyra's like, we ain't got time to get to the land of the dead. We gotta stop the story here. And then Will says something that I guess I'd never thought about or like put together or potentially heard them speak about in this book. He tells Mary, he says, as they neared the village, Will was telling Mary what he and Lyra had come to realise about the 3-part nature of human beings. And I was a little bit like, okay, have I missed something? Because I don't remember them having this conversation.
Same. I don't remember it either. I was like, is it the 3-part nature in that they're like, oh, we learned that humans have like the body, the demon, and then their death because they got to meet a death? Is it that? Or is it just generally mind-body-demon? Is that the 3-part nature? Because like it's not spelled out earlier, and then so Will spelling it out to Mary, but then not having it explained further in this chapter is like, did I miss something?
I've always assumed that it is, so you have the body, and you have your demon, and then you have your ghost in the world, whatever part of you goes to the world of the dead, because your body doesn't go and your demon doesn't go. And so they realize, yeah, there is a like 3-part nature that like whatever part of you goes to the world of the dead and whatever part of you is your demon is like 2 separate spiritual things.
Yeah, I guess that totally makes sense, doesn't it? Because we get a lot of Lee's story, especially in this book, is reuniting with Hester. So we know that you are essentially separated from your demon in your death, at least you were until obviously Lyra and Will took care of it. But yeah, that's interesting. It's just a weird one from Phil because he's usually really good at explaining stuff and hinting that you should pick up on it. And I mean, maybe it has been hinted a million times and I just didn't pick up on it. But yeah, it seemed I was like, okay, have I just missed this? Because there's a lot of chance that I might have at some point or forgot because I just have the worst memory ever.
I think it's just the way it's spelled out, like the 3-part nature. It feels like it should be a thing that's capitalized. It's like he's given it a title and we've not heard that title before, I think. But and we get like a little bit into Mary again, because she's talking, she brings back being like, oh, well, the church, the Catholic church I used to belong to, wouldn't use the word demon, but St. Paul talks about spirit and soul and body. And like, she's kind of bringing in this, oh, yeah, I do have this religion, this like strict religious upbringing that is like bringing to bear on my frame of references here. Like, this is what I relate to this. And I kind of love it because she's not mentioned a ton. I mean, I'm sure she told Lyra in The Subtle Knife that she was a nun, and Lyra was like, shooketh. But I think Mary bringing it up again now is kind of, it's giving us those like inklings of like, the kids are curious about the fact that Mary was a nun, and like, because she's mentioning it, we're just bringing it up. And I also adore that Will just goes, but the best part is the body.
Okay, it's very teenage boy of him. I love it.
Yes. It's just such a metaphysical conversation. He's like, yeah, but the best part's the body. He's not said it like that, but that's how I read it, because of course. And especially because that's why Phil's been saying the word flesh so much for the last few chapters, because Metatron wants the flesh. The angels want that flesh. Asriel knows that all they want is the flesh. So the best part is the body. And I'm so glad he said body and not flesh. Yes. Although he literally does say, it would be sort of ecstasy for them to have our flesh and our senses. So damn it, Phil did put flesh in there.
No. Yeah.
But also, love Lyra's interjecting in the story, being like, no, tell it when we get to it. Love a backseat storyteller.
And then again, her comment of, and she smiled at him, a smile of such sweet knowledge and joy that his senses felt confused. And again, there's all these like little hints at them getting closer and having these feelings that they don't know about. And it's very cute. And I'm glad that we're back on this train, because obviously when the huge battle was going on, we couldn't, there's no time to get into like this stuff properly. And I'm glad that we're, like you said, Jesse, being teased with it now at least. I'm like, yes, I'm ready for this.
The little quote that is, he smiled back and Mary thought his expression showed more perfect trust than she'd ever seen on a human face.
Yeah.
Right. Kills me. It's so adorable.
I know.
Will deserves nothing more than to feel that perfect trust, because we know his heart is very hard earned. He's not a trusting kid. Like, he's been burned. And I think it says a lot that like Mary can see that in his face, that he's got that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So Mary leaves them by the riverbank and she goes to help Atal prepare some food. This is where we learn what you said, Rach, about the Tualapi and them destroying villages in a different way than they usually do. And then Atal tells Mary that another tree has fallen, and we learn that dust is flowing a lot more strongly away now, because Mary visited that particular tree a couple of days ago and it was fine. So we are getting these, like you said, with the hint of the Tualapi coming, we're getting, you know, the hint of whatever's happening with dust, we need to figure it out soon, because that's also getting worse.
I love that Mary's response is just like, and now I feel the pressure. Great. Cool. But at least she's like, and I know what to do. It's fine. I've got my instruction manual. Tell them stories. Just tell them stories.
Yeah. And I guess this is where we get to the stories, right? So this is like the big, like the crux of the chapter, what we're all really excited to talk about with Mary and her story. I do have to say, and I think because we've read Mary this way for as long as we've been doing these books, and then obviously the TV show did it as well, it gives me a little bit of that she's not queer, or that we don't see her as a queer person in these books. I mean, we definitely see her as a queer person in these books, but the fact that the person that she's with is a man, I'm like, oh. And I don't want to be like that, because I want to celebrate love, but I just see her so much as a queer person that I'm a bit like, oh.
Yeah. It was such the right decision for the TV series to be like, this moment doesn't need to be a man. This moment needs to be a very lovely lady with a beautiful smile. Thank you.
I mean, especially since her sort of vibe of her whole story is like, modern lady, like, doesn't need a man. And there's always something like kind of queer about being like, I lived with a dude, it didn't work out. Like, I'm just kind of being like my like free, living free, like self. And it's just like, tell us more about these people you're meeting.
Yes. And also just like her leaving the church and like leaving that behind and things like that. That also gives like a vibe of, in stories like this where, you know, it wasn't really the norm to have, I know obviously we have Balthamos and Baruch in these books, but at the time it wasn't super the norm to have like queer characters, and us as queer people would read into these like little sections where it's like, oh, okay, so she is still kind of other, for want of a better phrase. Like she was supposed to do this thing. She was supposed to be a nun for her entire life, but she went against that. And she went against, like you said, Jessie, like not having a romantic partner because she was fine by herself. And I think, you know, as queer people, we've learned to read between the lines with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, especially with the like total separation from the church. Like, I know that, I don't know much about nuns, but it's like, it does seem like, okay, but you just want to like be with the dude. Like, I mean, the church still loves that, you know, cishet monogamy. And it's like, so it was something else. Something else is, you know?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So we are chilling by the fire. We're getting a bit of an update on like Lyra and Mary and how Lyra's like rocked Mary's world in a matter of days, and all of a sudden she was like on this wild adventure. And we have one of the most wonderful lines I think I've read from Mary, because Will is quizzing her on like, oh, if you're a scientist, I don't suppose that like it was a good thing for them to like tell you they were angels in dust, like that must have been wild. And Mary's like, no, it's fine, I knew about them because I used to be a nun. And the quote here is, but I knew about them. I used to be a nun, you see. I thought physics could be done to the glory of God till I saw there wasn't any God at all and that physics was much more interesting anyway. The Christian religion is a very powerful and convincing mistake. That's all.
I am obsessed. Obsessed with that line. Like, oh my God, Phil. Like, he has given us so many
diss tracks.
Diss tracks about religion. But like, this feels like the biggest one so far. Like, this feels like, because everything else he's given us is very like steamed in metaphors and wrapped up in that kind of stuff. But this one is like, no, no, no. Literally, the Christian religion is a mistake.
Because it's all been the magisterium. And this is like, no, this is Mary's world. This is your world. This is Will's world. I am talking about Christianity. It's not a metaphor. The magisterium is not this magical thing. It is blatantly the Catholic Church. And yes, just in case we weren't sure.
I know. I like love just how like matter of fact she says that. And it's like, oh, Phil Pullman, you could really try to tell people about the ambiguity about these series being like, leave the Catholic Church, leave Christianity and live your life. But like, this is like, right, directly a like powerful and convincing mistake. Couldn't agree more. Look at, I mean, yes, exactly. 110% you are correct, sir.
Yeah. Oh my God. Absolutely.
And then we get the story of all stories, where Lyra asks, when did you stop being a nun? And Mary remembers to the exact day and time of day, and I appreciate that. And we get like a little bit of a backstory on Mary's like relationship with the church and with being a nun, and how she was kind of part of what seemed like a relatively chill order of nuns. She didn't have to wear a habit, she didn't have to wear any of the regalia. It was just dress modestly and wear a crucifix, which feels like low, kind of just like lower levels of control than you would expect from a lot. It's not got magisterium energy, and yet she's obviously still able to have this revelation and break free from it. And like, they're fine with her doing physics, they're enjoying that she's doing well, she's at this cute little conference, she's enjoying like her freedom for the first time of like being sent out to this conference because she's done so well, she's so highly achieved, she's traveling for the first time ever, the like first time she's ever left the country, she's going to new places and meeting new people. And it turns out expanding your horizons and like meeting new people in new places is like really good for figuring some shit out.
Which is exactly why so many fundamentalist Christian organizations don't want women to like leave their home or go to school or have a job. Because it's like, once you expand your horizons, you're like, oh, actually, why am I doing this?
Yes. Mm-hmm. One thing that I like, I had a note on the part where she's talking about, you know, she like you said, Rich, she's on holiday. She goes to this meal. She meets this guy. And then she's like, he wasn't handsome and he wasn't a ladies' man or a charmer. And then that also gives me like comp het vibes. It's like, he's not handsome. And he's not really a charmer. Sure. Like, I can talk to this guy. Like, and I'm like, okay, yeah, sure. Comp het. Yeah.
Yes. Just a scooch before that, Mary's giving like a little thing on like how innocent she was when she was in the church. It's kind of like an important factor in the story, is that like she, despite being a grown woman, views herself as an innocent in that moment again, until, because she has the marzipan and the flashback that makes her realize she's felt this before. And I kind of love that, and the way that she's describing how she was basically like a teacher's pet of like Catholicism, I guess, because she's like, I was innocent. I'd been such a good little girl. I'd gone to mass regularly. I thought I had a vocation for the spiritual life. I wanted to serve God with all my heart. I wanted to take my whole life for it and offer it up like this. And like, again, Phil very blatantly being like, yes, I am talking about Christianity. She's like, she's holding her hands up. She's like, I wanted to offer up my life like this and place it in front of Jesus to do as he liked with. Mm. And I suppose I was pleasing myself too much. I was holy and I was clever. Ha. And that lasted until, about 9:30 on the evening of August the 10th, 7 years ago. And it's like, I love that she's kept a recollection of that moment. And also that, yeah, she's like recognizes that she was holier than thou. And like, and that that shattered for her. And that was part of her innocence, a part of her like, devoutness, was that feeling of being like, yes, I'm holy and I'm clever, ha, I'm better than you. And then she's like, until this time when everything shattered and I realized life was actually way cooler than that.
I think that's why I love like Mary's vibe. She's very she obviously tells a great story, but she's talking to these two children like they're adults, and I love that. She's not like holding back, she's not like sugarcoating what she's saying. She's saying it matter-of-factly, and she's also funny. Like, I love the bit where she's talking about flirting and she's like, Sister Mary Malone, flirting? What about my vows? What about dedicating my life to Jesus and all that? And I love how like blasé she is about that as well. It's just so great.
No, I love that. I love how blasé she is about it all. I love the way that she like tells the story again, like you said, with it's not too adult because she is speaking to like young teens, but she's also not like talking down to them, and the way that she's coming across is lovely. The way that she describes the man as being like, he was only a little older than me and he has soft black hair, beautiful olive colored skin and dark eyes. His hair kept falling across his forehead and he kept pushing it back like that slowly, and she shows them and like Will again, sick burn on Mary's like, Will thought she looked as if she remembered it very well.
She's been dreaming about it every night since it happened. It's fine.
Yes. And yeah, it's just really sweet the way she's describing it. We get a lot of descriptions of like the senses and the sounds that are happening that also hark back to some of the descriptions we got of the things that she was thinking about in the chapter when she is at the top of the platform and she has her like out of body experiences, and she's thinking of like sounds and smells and things that like to bring her back to her body. And I remember strongly that one of those things was lemon trees in Lisbon, and it's like, this is those lemon trees that she's remembering the smell of to bring her back to herself.
I also just love this section because like, I mean, now as an adult, like the sort of sensuality and like pleasures of the body she's describing is like eating a delicious meal, having a glass of wine, being outside, like having this like really like stimulating conversation with like other people. I'm like, that sounds so great. Like, that sounds so appealing. Is just be eating grilled seafood and drinking delicious wine at like an outdoor table under like where it's like warm. Oh my god, it's just like, yeah, that versus I don't know, living in a like one room in a like nunnery where you're just like denying yourself so many things. I'm just like, why would you go back to that?
Exactly, for sure. And like, it goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this chapter, where it's like, well, yeah, I could experience all these amazing things and like live in the present and have these great conversations and drink this wine and all the things you just said, Jesse. Why would I not do that? Like, why would I dedicate my life to something that I don't even know if it's real? I don't even know what's going to happen to me when I die.
Yeah.
Why would I not just live in the present and do whatever the fuck I wanted, whenever the fuck I wanted to do it?
Yeah.
We have this moment. She's sitting there and she's given a box of sweets, specifically marzipan, which I love that Lyra has to interject and figure out what it is. And we get the beginning of this China analogy that she starts going on about, which like, I understand the sentiment, but the way that like she keeps just being like, it's just like China throughout this chapter, like for some reason it felt humorous to me by the end of the chapter because she talks about it so much. I'd made myself believe that I was fine and happy and fulfilled on my own without the love of anyone else. Being in love was like China. You knew it was there, and no doubt it was very interesting, and some people went there, but I never would. I'd spend my life without ever going to China, but it wouldn't matter because there was the rest of the world to visit. And I love that. I love that also as a description that like feels like a very like lovely way of thinking about being ace as well, of like being like, yeah, China exists, and I know that a lot of people love visiting there, but like the entire rest of the world is really cool, and I'm really enjoying it actually. And like the fact that that's what Mary thought for herself is a beautiful thing, and it's beautifully described. But again, the way that we then like jump into this realization that she has of like, that's not for her, that's not what she's realized for herself. And also this moment of this sense memory of the marzipan is what brings her back and makes her realize, oh wait, no, I do remember that, and actually it's something I've been denying myself, but because of oppressive religious stuff, as opposed to because of me recognizing my own wants and needs.
Yeah,
absolutely. I love the fact that it is this sense memory. I really love that. I love that the chapter is called Marzipan. I love that it is the marzipan that ties all of this together, and just like how important those like seemingly small things at the time can really have like an impact on your entire life. It's like, you know, if you smell a certain smell, you might get taken back to like, for me, it's like if I smell grass, I think of my parents' old back garden when I was a kid, and like stuff like that is just so important to like the fabric of life. And again, being in the present when that gets you, yes, it takes you back, but then you kind of relate to where you are in that moment. And I just think the fact that it's something really small and random like marzipan is just really beautiful.
I also have to say that because like Pullman has often sort of referenced what this series, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is called.
Chronicles of Narnia.
I finally forgot about that.
C.S. Lewis?
Yes.
Yeah.
Since he's often referencing how he is like also sort of taking shots at C.S. Lewis, especially like the last book in the series, I have to say that I appreciate his iconic food thing being marzipan, which is so much better than Turkish Delight, as someone who, when I read the book, I'm like, Turkish Delight must be good as hell. And then I eat, and then I ate it, and I'm like, I cannot enjoy this. I don't understand why anyone would sell their family out to eat this.
So gross. It's like,
it's so gross.
Yeah.
So, but marzipan, delicious.
I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of marzipan either, though, sadly. It makes me think too much of like Christmas cake.
I feel like I like marzipan a lot better than I like Turkish Delight. 100%.
True. On the scale. Yes.
On the scale. Yeah, for sure.
And I think like a lot of things, if you get a good quality marzipan, it's really good. And if it's like a cheaper version, you're just like, what is this?
Yeah, for sure. So now we get this marzipan allegory, and we learn about this boy at this disco that she met.
Mary's first ever crush.
Yeah. And they had some dancers. Although the only bit that like gets me about this, as in like feels a little bit off, is the fact that there's this, I'm assuming, I can't remember if it does it, yeah, she's 12, right? So, and then there's this other, I assume 12-year-old, like just feeding her marzipan like from this birthday cake. I'm like, I don't know if I would enjoy someone just, somebody that I didn't know that I'd maybe been dancing with for a little bit, just like trying to feed me something. That wouldn't sit well with me.
It feels like the melodrama of like, this is going to be so romantic, but of like a 15 or 16-year-old, not of like a 12 or 13-year-old, if that makes sense. Of like, this is going to be so romantic when I do this. Like, actually, imagining like, oh, I could see him handing it to her, but like him actually shoving a sweet in her mouth. It's just such a weird image.
I don't know. I feel like I kind of love it just because it's like, I feel like I've always envisioned it as being a like, he's like slowly putting it in her mouth and like touches her lips and just sort of the like, I don't know, sensual awareness of like touching in a way that's like not the way that like, you know, kids will like grapple and they'll wrestle, but like the kind of like post-puberty like, oh I see now.
It's a beautiful image, but then I just like, if you imagine putting yourself in those shoes, all I can think about is how awkward it is. It's like beautiful, wonderful, cannot imagine it. I would just laugh or like, and spitting out at the guy. That's why I'm not Mary Malone, having a beautiful, wonderful awakening. So
we then get this interesting change in Lyra, which I will read the description. As Mary said that, Lyra felt something strange happen to her body. She felt a stirring at the roots of her hair. She found herself breathing faster. She had never been on a roller coaster or anything like one, but if she had, she would have recognised the sensations in her breast. They were exciting and frightening at the same time, and she had not the slightest idea why. The sensation continued and deepened and changed as more parts of her body found themselves affected too. She felt as if she'd been handed the key to a great house she hadn't known was there, a key that was somehow inside her, and as she turned the key, deep in the darkness of the building, she felt other doors opening too, and lights coming on. She sat trembling, hugging her knees, hardly daring to breathe, as Mary went on. This is giving, like, panic attack vibes to me.
Oh.
It's described in a way that feels like a panic attack, but I guess, like, kind of a positive one, because there's a lot of excitement in there, but you know, there's stuff about her like trembling and being on a roller coaster and things like that, and even like the roots of her hair stirring, things like that. Very visceral, like reminders of me to what a panic attack feels like.
See, for me, I thought it was just like that, yeah, that first time you get goosebumps and it's like, oh, this isn't from being cold, this is goosebumps. This is like a moment here, but like I can see what you mean in terms of it being the like the shortness of breath, the like there's a lot of physical things there, that there is an overlap, but I guess it's the like undertone of excitement as opposed to anxiety that makes it this like moment.
For sure, because sometimes, I mean, obviously everyone's experience is different, but for me there is like a very thin line between excitement and like pure dread of like a panic attack. Like it could go either way. There's that feeling that you get inside of you, which are like the roller coaster description. It's kind of like, well, do I like this or is this horrendous? And I feel like she's gone the other way for that.
I do beg to differ that Lyra doesn't know what it feels like to be on a roller coaster, because last chapter they were riding Malefas down a really steep hill.
That's true.
And that is, we all agreed that that would be a great roller coaster ride in the Histo-Material theme park. So
yeah, I mean, she's like done some pretty wild stuff, so it's kind of, I think you're right, there's just like a thin line between like my body's doing something and it really just depends on like how I'm feeling in my brain. It's really gonna depend on if this is like I'm having an anxiety attack or like I'm really just digging whatever. It's like it's more of a like sensual like goosebumps and like you're, you know, feeling it in your chest. I also would be remiss if we didn't talk about, I don't know if y'all are aware of that part of that paragraph is like 2/3 of it is not in the US editions.
Oh, I did not know that.
Oh, I'm so excited to talk about this. Okay.
Yes, please.
For the most part, this is like, I think one of two changes between the UK version and the US editions is one is the change from Northern Lights to the Golden Compass, which, okay, whatever. But in the US editions, this paragraph, so it starts with like Lyra felt something strange happen to her in her body, and then it continues on with she felt as she'd been handed a key to a great house that she hadn't known was there. So they cut out like, what is that, like 2 or 3 sentences, because apparently some publisher was like, this seems too explicit for a kid's novel. And I'm like,
oh my god,
right? But I'm like, it's not explicit, like it's all metaphor. It's like this could be like, I mean, it is kind of clear that, like, talking about it, it's like Lyra is having a sort of like sensual, like budding sexuality response to like, you know, the feelings that Mary is describing, but it's like so innocent. It's like, I don't think that if 11, well, maybe like 14-year-old me would have been like, oh, okay. But it's, we have like parts later in the book where it's like, they're very clearly having, you know, Lyra, like what Lyra is feeling is like her like budding sexual awareness of herself. So it's so weird that those like sentences are cut out of the US edition.
Yeah.
It's so weird. Cause we knew that, cause I think we talked about it, God, when we first started the books, didn't we? We knew that there were at least some things cut from the Amber Spyglass guy. I guess I just didn't realize it was this, because like literally like a couple of pages before we have Mary saying that the Christian religion is a mistake. And is that still in the American version? Like, if they were cutting anything, it would have been that kind of stuff.
That's a good question. I actually went out of my way to get a UK edition because all of my previous editions were the US. And I'm like, why is there parts that I'm missing? I don't like that. So I got but I listened to the audiobook version earlier from my library and I'm like, oh yeah, they cut that part out. I don't remember if they cut out the part about it being a convincing mistake or not.
I'll have a look, and then for next chapter, yeah, we'll see. But that is crazy to me, because you're so right in the sense that the paragraph that, you know, I just read and that we were talking about is just so innocent to me. Obviously, you know, there are undertones, but it's just as a teenager would feel in that moment, that kind of awakening of that kind of stuff. It's very strange to me.
It makes sense to me as an American, because a lot of crap like that is so puritanical and like seeped in Christian mores, where it's like, oh, we can't have this girl have a like sexual awakening in this book for young adults where she literally helps kill God. And I'm like, what? Seriously?
Like, we've literally had like polar bears smacking each other's jaws off and like eating hearts and like cliff gas like tucking into a still warm liver, and they're like, but God forbid somebody get the goosebumps because they heard something that resonated with them.
No, this is like such a like thing across American media where it's like the most disgusting violence, totally fine, take your teenagers too. Anyone is like kissing or having sex, adults only, don't have it. Like, we gotta shelter our kids. And it's just like, can we get our priorities straight? And a lot of it is just Christian bullshit seeped into American culture that I despise for obvious reasons.
I'm intrigued to see if like Mary's story is identical in yours as well, because I guess obviously that is cut because it's explicitly about Lyra, but then we do get Mary talking about being a 12-year-old kissing another kid of a similar age and talking about how when they were together, she's like, I think it was at that party, or it might have been at another one. We kissed each other for the first time. It was in a garden, and there was a sound of music from outside and the quiet and cool among the trees. And I was aching, and all my body was aching for him. And I could tell that he felt the same. And we were both almost too shy to move. But then one of us did suddenly, without any interval in between. It was a quantum leap, and suddenly we were kissing each other. And oh, it was more than China. It was paradise. The like description of her being like aching for somebody feels like way more specifically sexual than like Lyra having goosebumps and like noticing the reaction of her body.
I think a lot of that is there. I don't have, like, the American version is the audiobook that I was listening to earlier, so I can't fact check how much is missing, but I definitely know for sure those like two or three sentences are, and it's made me very angry for years.
Yes. I'm going to put a sad little pin in the next bit that Mary says, which is, we saw each other about half a dozen times, no more. And then his parents moved away and I never saw him again. It was such a sweet time. So short, but there it was. I'd known it. I had been to China. And I'm just... we're going to put a pin in that, and that's fine. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll chat about that another time.
From time to time, we drop ominous pins in things, and then we actually might not come back to them, but...
Well, we forget a lot of the time. I do like the... speaking of the paragraph, the infamous paragraph where there's things removed in the American version, I do, and we come back to it a little bit later on, but I do really like the like house metaphor of, you know, it unlocking something within Lyra, and like... things have been lit up that weren't lit up before. She can go in these different rooms and see through these different windows that maybe she couldn't before. And I really like that as a metaphor for what's happening within her. It's really great.
We then have Lyra literally recognizing that immediately after Mary said that thing and saying she had no idea that this house was inside her all along, with all of its inside her, that rich house with all its doors open and all its rooms lit, stood waiting, quiet, expectant. And it's like, oh, the house.
And like, I don't know, just like what a like healthy acknowledgement of like consensual adolescent desire and like sexuality. Like what, like, you know, Mary is like playing the serpent, but like what she's offering them isn't like forbidden knowledge. It's just like, this is what happens when you're a young person, unless you're, you know, generally speaking, like, I'm not sure for ace people how early they realize, you know, but puberty hits, you know, that's for a lot of folks when they start to realize that they have like sexual desires and like maybe getting more like, and like sensual desire. So it's not even like it's forbidden as much as like there's fruit that like is there and then it gets ripe and then you notice it because you're just like, when was this tree full of fruit? Like what? And then it's like, it was always going to be there. It's always there, you know?
It's almost like that being given like a comprehensive and ethical like introduction to like an emotional sex education that all children and teenagers should be given access to.
Oh my god, yeah.
And that is weirdly a divisive topic.
Yeah, a not a judge a judgment-free, like, sex education and not, like, your desires are sinful and you're going to hell unless you're in the marriage bed. And it's like, oh, yeah. No, actually.
No, you will all get chlamydia and die. yes.
We get, like, another really, really good paragraph. Well, a little more than a paragraph, actually, from Mary, which I'll read a little bit of. And at 9:30 in the evening at that restaurant table in Portugal... Mary continued, quite unaware of the silent drama going on in Lyra, which I enjoy that. There's just like this entire thing going on inside Lyra and just has no idea. Someone gave me a piece of marzipan and it all came back. And I thought, am I really going to spend the rest of my life without ever feeling that again? I thought, I want to go to China. It's full of treasures and strangeness and mystery and joy. I thought, will anyone be better off if I go straight back to the hotel and say my prayers and confess to the priest and promise never to fall into temptation again? Will anyone be the better for making me miserable? And the answer came back, no, no one will. There's no one to fret, no one to condemn, no one to bless me for being a good girl, no one to punish me for being wicked. Heaven was empty, and I didn't know whether God had died or whether there had never been a God at all. Either way, I felt free and lonely, and I didn't know whether I was happy or unhappy, but something very strange had happened, and all that huge change came about as I had the marzipan in my mouth, before I'd even swallowed it. A taste, a memory, a landslide. Oh, so yes, great. Mary.
Such a, like, not only such a great revelation, but the way that she lays it out is just like, exactly. Like, who benefits from you not eating marzipan and drinking fine wine and, like, kissing people? Like, just the patriarchal church. It's like, for what? No.
Exactly. Exactly. I love the, I guess, the way that it's laid out as well. And also the way that when something changes in your life, that's such a huge, huge change. I like that Phil has kind of put it on the table that, you know, I think there's a trope where, you know, you make this big change in your life and you're supposed to immediately be happy and it's supposed to change your life immediately in that moment and everything will be fine. But the fact that Phil, you know, kind of has Mary be like, well, she didn't know if she was unhappy or if she was happy. She felt lonely. Like, she felt all these things, but she still knew that that's what she wanted to do and she did it. I really like that because I think especially in children's literature, there's definitely like, oh, if you make a big change, it's either going to be really, really good or right. really, really bad. And the, I feel like Phil likes to play in that grey area a lot, which I also mm-hmm. like.
I also love for the way that Mary is telling her story is like, she's just laying out how she, her interaction with that experience. She's not saying, and so kids, there is no God and you should do what I did. It's, and this was my experience. And she's just laying the story on the table. There's literally no preaching to it. She's not preaching at them or to them. She's just telling them her story and her experience. And I love that because they've both probably come from worlds where grown-ups just tell you what to do and how to exist. And Mary's not done that. She's not told them what to do at any point. She's just laid out her experience and like shared the knowledge. And that's really beautiful, like the way she communicates it.
Yeah. And I mean, in a lot of ways, she's like one of the best adults we see the two of them interact with because she's just like living her life. And it's just like, you know, I'm here to help in the capacity that like I've been sent on this, like, I don't know, figuring out the mysteries of the universe, which is what I've sort of pledged my life to, my, you know, post-church modern lady life. And like, let me help out these kids by telling them some stories about how I have lived my life and stopped being a nun. And I think what's even great, which I feel like is also sort of a queer vibe, is that, and the kids can see that like, Mary's doing great. Like, she wasn't punished with a capital P, for like leaving the church and being a scientist. And she's been, you know, hanging out in this world and she's like, you know, taking care of them now and is like, you know, deeply curious and interested and like open to share things, which unfortunately a lot of adults in their lives so far in this journey have not. And it's like, thank God. It's just like someone who's lived like being the like cool queer aunt. And you're just like, oh, I could just live this life and that could just be what I'm doing and nothing's, and like no one's gonna smite me or whatever. I'm just gonna be a person in the world.
Yeah, for sure. And also like Mary giving them this that gift is so special, and for her to like not like sugarcoat anything or like not tell the story differently to like appease to the fact that they're children is like such a gift. Like I remember when I was growing up, I had a few of like my parents' friends that were like that, and that it really helped ship me as a person, and it's just such a, I just love Mary, you know? Like, I want her to be my pal. Like, oh, I know. Gosh, she's like, great.
Yeah, she's incredible. And, like, this is, like, also sort of why it's important to have, like, healthy intergenerational relationships between, like, young people and, like, I mean, Mary isn't old, but she's, like, older than them, you know? And she's not, right, she's not, like, preaching to them. She's just like, hey, leaving the church was great for me, it turns out.
Yeah.
So great. I threw my crucifix into the sea, which is a great move, full of drama. Yes. Here for that. Yes.
Yeah. I love that Lyra asks about Oliver Payne and asks if it's him.
I love that she tells her story and then actually is kind of like immediately bombarded with Lyra questions because it's very Lyra.
Yes.
What about the skull man? Who was he? Okay, you didn't kiss him. What about him? Did you kiss him? What? And then Will being like, was it hard to leave the church? And like, did you marry him? What went on? What happened? And like, Lyra's like, what was the boy called? Tell me what the boy was called. And like, all the kid questions are perfect. Because it's like, they're not going to take it on board like adults and be like, oh, that's such a transformative story. Thank you for sharing with me. They're going to be like, but what was he called? And did you kiss him? And did you marry him? Like, yes.
Yeah. Again, like this gift that Mary has given them, like what you said, Jesse, about them asking the questions that they think that this, because they're children and they've been told what they've been told. And obviously they've been on this big adventure and it has changed them. But still, Lyra thinks that man and woman together should get married, kind of thing. That's like her linear experience of like what happens in her world. So then the fact that Mary's like, no, I didn't marry him, like I lived with someone for 4 years and like he taught me how to climb and like I enjoy that, but I'm on my own and I'm happy. Again, such like a gift, a different way of living that they might not have known about before.
Yeah, especially in this sort of intense patriarchal subjugation that happens with the magisterium.
Also Mary, again, the Mary Coulter comparisons that can be made of like Mary having a life-changing moment of falling in love while being dedicated to the church and it resulting in her leaving the church and then going on to live a full, healthy, balanced life, not full of religious trauma. Coulter falls in love and it results in her downfall from grace within the church, and it just completely traumatizes her and leads to some incredibly unhealthy ways of thinking.
Oh yeah, that damage Miss Coulter in a way where it's like, obviously it turns out because it has to turn out, but it's like, it didn't have to be this way.
That's why I love the Mary Coulter meeting scene in the TV series, because they had to get put together so Coulter could have seen what could have been. And it's like,
oh my God, I like, I'm still like, I think in the middle of like season one, but the fact that that happens brings me so much joy because that's like,
oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't
No, that's fine.
You.
I don't mind spoilers. I'm just like, oh, like that's what the joy of having a television adaptation of a book is, that you can be like, let's throw these two characters together that you know you want to see, and I'm like, I do, thank you.
Oh, you've got some good stuff coming. You've got some real good stuff coming then.
Oh yeah,
enjoy some choices.
Okay.
Yeah. So when like Will asks about Mary leaving the church, there's a really interesting part where Mary's kind of like, well, everyone was disappointed in me and their faith depended on Mary carrying on. It gives that vibe of that their faith in this thing, in this religion, is also very flimsy, to the point where they're like, well, Mary's doing it. She's a nun. She's doing it all. So we can just put all our hopes on her. And having her turn against it obviously shook them as well, which is very interesting, I think. And another swipe in the church from Phil.
Nothing says Christianity more than giving apparently more shits about what someone else believes than actually just like sitting in your own faith and like understanding what you believe and just having that be just for you, and that's fine. No, you've got to make other people's business your business. Like, yeah, nothing quite says organized religion quite like that, so.
Yeah, I keep seeing this phrase online that I've been thinking about all week, which is there's no hate like Christian love. Just
ooh,
like,
yeah.
Whoever said that, A plus.
Yes. Oh my God, yeah. There's a good bit here about good and evil, which I really like. And it's definitely, obviously, one of the main themes of this book is that there's good and bad in everyone. So I will just find that and read it. So Will says, when you stopped believing in God, did you stop believing in good and evil? And she said, no, but I stopped believing there was a power of good and a power of evil that were outsiders. And I came to believe that good and evil are names for what people do, not for what they are. All we can say is that this is a good deed because it helps someone, or that's an evil one because it hurts them. People are too complicated to have simple labels. And I really feel that that's just Phil putting it straight down on the page. All those conversations we've had about Asriel and Coulter and the grey area between, especially Coulter with her like somewhat redemption arc, and Asriel to a certain extent, that's Phil like literally putting it down on paper near the end of the book again. This is where he's just telling us for a fact that this is what we should have been thinking this whole time.
Exactly.
It's very like Aesop's fables of him. Like, and here is the moral of my story right at the end.
Yeah. It's also very interesting. And again, just real, that Mary misses God. She misses the feeling of being connected to the universe. How she puts it, she misses feeling connected to God or a God. And I can definitely understand that. I think that as much as I am against organized religion, I think that, you know, it's very helpful for a lot of people, isn't it? To put their belief in something that's bigger than them and then to make the choice yourself to stop believing in that and, you know, essentially go it alone for the first time is obviously going to be like such a scary move. And again, I love that she is honest about that with the kids as well, because she could have just been like, no, it's fine. It was all good. But the fact that, again, she's honest, it's just really great.
And also, but like the fact that she ends it on, it's like, but if he's not there, then kind of what's the point? What am I missing? I'm missing nothing. The fact that that stretches out into far out on the marshes, a bird is calling, and we get a description of everything that is happening around them just to remind us that, like, actually, no, that's being connected to the universe is like observing all of the tiny things that are around you and just sitting in that moment. Because having that moment described is lovely. Also, the description of a towel sitting like a cat, like fully loafing, yeah, with all the little legs tucked in and her wheels to one side. Adorable. Here for it.
I really enjoy this last description of Lyra. So as for Lyra, she hadn't moved a muscle since that strange thing had happened, and she held the memory of those sensations inside her like a fragile vessel brimful of new knowledge, which she hardly dared touch for fear of spilling it. She didn't know what it was or what it meant or where it had come from, so she sat still, hugging her knees, and tried to stop herself trembling with excitement. Soon, she thought. Soon I'll know very soon.
Oh, Lyra.
I love the metaphor of her holding the memory of those sensations inside her and not daring to like touch it in case it spills out. I think that's a really good metaphor for like learning something new about yourself and then like kind of not daring to go near it for a little bit because you're not sure like how it's going to impact your life. And if you touch it or spill it, then your life might change and you might not be ready for that yet. And I do, it's a great metaphor. Phil is fucking great at metaphors.
He likes to throw in things that are just like fit and feel right. And you're like, oh, yes, perfect.
I know, his books are written so good.
I am both a person with a house inside me and I'm also holding a cup full of water. Thank you.
Mary's run out of stories, right? She's tired. She wants to go to bed, which is fair. And then that means that we've reached the end of the chapter. And I wanted to ask you, Jesse, if you had anything else, anything in your notes that we didn't cover that you wanna chat about.
I think we actually covered everything.
Amazing. Well, I always say at the end of a chapter, overall, really good chapter. Enjoy. This chapter is so big for like spelling out the entire meaning of the book, and to have Mary be the person that delivers all these messages feels perfect. It's why Mary is like all of our queer aunt, that like she's the Sue or the Carol or the whoever that woman is in our life that just shows up and is just like, I'm just going to be your font of knowledge that you need to rely on. Like, yes. And I love that for Mary. It's a reason why Simone Kirby is such perfect casting, because she had that exact same energy. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful moments. And like a really nice chilled chapter. After we've had a lot of very stressful chapters, and it is so nice to have had a chapter that is just friends sharing stories. It's like, is that what it's all about? Is this what it's all about? Yes.
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 Rach, I do have a request for your illustration that you're going to do for this.
Mm-hmm.
Please, can you illustrate just a cross being thrown into the sea?
Oh, okay. I thought you were about to say like somebody like touching Marzi Battle. Oh, no. I was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm sorry. I'm not illustrating that awkward moment that fills me with cringe. I will happily draw a cross being yeeted into the sea. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Love and Mary it. Triumphantly like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Overarm. Boom. Definitely an overarm mm-hmm. throw.
So at the end of each chapter, we give out an award for the character that we feel has done the best, you know, or that we feel like an affinity with this chapter. I have a feeling that we might have all picked the same.
I also feel that.
Yes. But Jessie, tell us who you picked.
Mary is the clear MVP of this chapter. We are finally seeing the sort of mysterious role that she was assigned to in book two, and we're like, the fuck does that mean? Be the serpent. Okay, whatever. And then you're like, oh. And you're like, no, this is great. You're doing a great job. I love you so much, Mary.
Yes. And I mean, I will just go next and just say, agree, 100%. Mine's for Mary too. Just everything that she's done this chapter. I'm so into it. I just love her so much as a character. I feel like obviously, this is exactly what it is. Her entire story has been leading to this moment. And it's just such a beautiful, like, culmination of, like, everything we've learned about Mary. It's also really nice to have this time with Mary, because especially in the Amber Spyglass, a lot of the time we have with her, and we don't really see her that much in The Subtle Knife, really, is very fleeting, because it's like, oh, she's building a spyglass. The chapters are actually really short. Because we were saying, like, when we were in the, like, trenches of this book, because obviously it's quite a long book to do chapter by chapter, we were always happy when it was a Mary chapter, because obviously we get to see Mary, but also they're usually really short.
Like, this is an easy episode.
Yeah. For that all to culminate in this, like, really lovely, substantial amount of time with Mary was really lovely. And, yeah, it's such a great chapter.
Yeah, and just, like, learning so much about her and being, like, I think, especially as an adult, I'm like, yes, I understand why you would want to throw your cross into the ocean.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
It would be remiss for me not to also give the award to Mary, but the fact that you both have given it to Mary is, like, kind of making me want to be a house cat and, like, push the glass off the table and just give a towel an award for being cute and lying down and being sleepy. But I suppose Mary gets it too. Yes, of course she does. She's rocked everybody's worlds, as she has the right to do.
Truly.
Yes. She really has.
In fact, I think my notes literally in all caps is awards, Mary, obvs. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I have to read you my notes, which is Mary gets the award for being the best serpent. Sorry, Crowley from Good Omens.
Oh, you've made some enemies there, but it's fine.
Sorry, everyone. I know we all love David Tennant.
Fun fact, we were in Scotland the other week and David Tennant does the voiceover for the Loch Ness Monster Museum, and it was a lovely time.
Oh, my God. Good. Okay, well, now if I'm ever in the UK, I got to go to the Loch Ness Monster Museum, which I was going to go to probably anyway, because cryptids.
Of course.
Oh my God. Of course he does.
It's like a cute little interactive walkthrough thing. And David Tennant is just like talking you through the whole time. And you're like, oh, thanks, David.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was so great. It was so great. He was like the perfect addition to it. He just made it. And I was like, yes, this is fucking great. We've come to the end of our time with you, Jessie. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been a long time in the works, and ever since you expressed interest in coming on, we've been so excited for it, and it's been so great, and I'm so glad that we got to talk about this chapter. So yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's so good to just talk about this chapter and just like this book, and it's because it's just been a dream. Thank you.
Yes. Same for us. It's been so great.
Before we roll out and do the credits, would you like to tell us where the people can find you, where we can get more Jessie content in our lives?
Folks can check out all of the podcasts I described at the beginning at #ruthless.com. You can find all of our podcasts, including any podcatcher you might listen to. And we are also on Instagram at #ruthlesspods.
It's important to know that hashtag is spelled out. Write the word. Don't put the hashtag.
Don't put in the symbol. You have to write the word out. Folks can see all the me and my co-host Lark scream about so many things that we love.
Yeah. And honestly, definitely do, because your podcast is some of my favorites. And Rach and I were talking before we got on here, and we were just like, in awe of how you and Lark actually do so many podcasts. Like, we struggle just making this one, and you guys are just all over it, and it's just so great.
Yeah, we're taking some strategic breaks on a couple of them just to sort of make it a little bit less intense for the both of us. But still, yeah, we love making podcasts and hyper-focusing on so many things. So it works out.
I can't wait for the next, not only the next season of Our Flag Means Death, but also your coverage of it, because the Gay Pirate podcast is amazing. So yes, I can't wait.
Yeah, January 2024. We're very excited.
Yes.
Pop it in your diaries.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Her Dark Materials. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at HDMPod, and you can email us at herdarkmaterialspod@gmail.com. You can also visit our website at hdmpod.co.uk.
If you want to support us, you can become a patron at patreon.com/hdmpod. We also have a shop where you can buy merch featuring all original artwork from Rich. You can find it at hdmpod.co.uk/shop. I'm Fear, and when I'm not talking to Rach and Jesse, you can find me talking about Paramore on my other podcast, Still Into You. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts and find us on Twitter and Instagram at Still Into You Pod.
I'm Rachel, and when I'm not here chatting to you lovely folks about how bloody amazing Mary Malone is and how she should be all of our moms, I'm making cute and magical arty things. You can find me over on Instagram at RachMakes, on Twitter and TikTok at Rach_makes, and over in my online shop, rachmakes.co.uk. The theme music for the podcast was written and produced by Johnny Knott.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. And don't forget,
keep telling stories,
and all will be well.
Podcasting.